Saturdays live, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Steven Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, May 9, 2015. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. The new jobs report came out yesterday, Friday, and the labor statistics show that we've added another, I think it was 242,000 jobs in April, bringing the unemployment rate down to 5.4%, or at least that's what the news is. And at least it sounds like good news, right? But so many people, so many of those jobs don't pay enough to live on, and so many people in the American middle class that used to thrive are not thriving now. And to discuss how we got there and how to navigate that crisis, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the program Jim Mascara. Jim, welcome back to TalkRadio1.com.
Good morning, Steve.
What I'd like to do, you've published a new book called Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. And what I would like to do is read from it. I'm looking at page 224, and I'm just going to read one paragraph. How stressed is the American consumer, and what is their ability to pay a mortgage? A MetLife study found that 45% of Americans, if they lost their job, have 1 month of savings before they are unable to meet financial obligations. A disturbing 19% indicated that a two-week loss of income creates the same problem. Even more shocking were the 59% of respondents who felt they were living paycheck to paycheck. Jim, what's going on?
You know, Stephen, this reminds me of when I was in engineering school. We used to have something that was called a factor of safety that you would build into engineering designs. And part of that concept was if you were building a bridge or some sort of a structure, and you had a truck that weighed, 50,000 pounds going across it, you could design the structure to where it would withstand the 50,000 pounds, but with good engineering practice, you would build factors of safety of two or three times. So even if you were wrong on the maximum weight of a truck that would pass over that structure, you would still be fine. Unfortunately, right now, we do not have that factor of safety built into the economic platform, if you will, of most Americans. And the St. Louis Federal Reserve actually has a really neat statistic that they started probably 20 or so years ago that they called the Financial Stress Index. And if you look at that index, a level of zero indicates a normally functioning financial economy from a stress perspective. Since 2010, so we're talking about the last 5 years, and this is all, of course, post-recession recovery period, that index has been negative. So, despite the notion of a recovery, the St. Louis Fed, anyway, from their financial stress index, suggests that we're still under a great deal of financial stress.
My guest is Jim Mascara. He is an author and a fellow who's thought a lot about this. His background, he's got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree as an industrial engineer from the University of Missouri. He's a principal at Sentinel Consulting, a business restructuring and capital acquisition firm that restructures debt and increases liquidity to help small businesses stay alive and well. And he, of course, operates the financial and economic site, The Sentinel. So there's no margin for safety, Jim. How did we get there?
Wow, that's a really long, long tortuous path. But I started the first edition of the book in 2011, and when I did the refresh of the book here a couple months ago, I wanted to start out with the fundamentals. And so if you go back to your academic days, particularly in the subject of math, you really didn't go to calculus until you had algebra and the sound fundamentals in arithmetic. And so that's why the first chapter of my book, I start out with what money is. And why it came about, and more importantly, how it changed over time. And I think that's probably the thing that the analysis that is probably escapes most people is that, they see these things that are going on today, and they see the machinations of what I'll call the wizards of people in central banking and government. But it all goes back to, what the unit of money is that we have, how that came about, how it changed and morphed over time. And because of those changes, some of the manipulation that can occur with that money, and then some of the imbalances that I think that we're seeing today in the economy and monetary policy as well.
So let me set the stage for this. I'm 62 years old. I will be next week 62 years old. And when I was growing up, and I certainly know from my mom and dad's generation, when you wanted to buy something, what you did is you saved your money until you had enough, and then you went and bought it. And credit cards didn't exist as such. When there were charge cards, but they were paid off at the end of the month, and it was just for the convenience of not having to carry cash. And what we know today as MasterCard was known as MasterCharge, and it was a whole different thing. So the idea of getting something now and paying for it and paying much more for it over a period of time just didn't even exist, and it would have been regarded as reckless by most of my parents' generation. The closest thing that I can remember is there was a layaway plan. So if you decided that you wanted something and you thought it might not be available later, there were stores, department stores, where you could go and you could pay a small amount of money and they would lay it away for you. They would set it aside. They would put your name on it. You could save up the money and come back. And that was to induce you to come back and buy it because it was laid away. And so that's what was visible then. Now, today, if people want something and they don't have the money, it's so easy to get credit. Is that the center of the problem, Jim?
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. And, you know, I have some economic laws that I created when I did the first book. And the first one of those is called credit equals confidence. And credit is actually from a Latin word, credere, which means to believe. And so there has to be a strong belief on the part of the borrower that they're going to be able to pay something back, and then the creditor that they're going to be paid back. And so that's a process that has always been there. And I don't want anyone to come away from this discussion thinking, well, all credit is bad, because it's really not. It's just how you use that credit. And ICE marked 1981, 82 roughly as the start of a major, major credit cycle in the United States, probably the world, but let's just relegate our discussion to the United States. And since that time, since 1982, if you look at a lot of measures of credit expansion, stock markets, the bond market, et cetera, you will see a really, really strong correlation to that. You'll also see some correlations to a very popular topic now relating to income inequality. So the whole notion of credit is very, very necessary, but it's really more on the application of that credit. Does that credit get used for productive purposes? Is it self-liquidating? And by self-liquidating, I mean, if I go borrow some money and then I use those borrowed funds for some purpose, is that purpose going to allow me to generate cash in order to pay off the original loan? And I think that what you've seen is, particularly since 1981, 82, is that we've had a great deal of expansion in this non-self-liquidating credit, and it's very, very consumption-oriented. Because of that, and because of, you know, general policies and a belief, again, back to the word credit, but it's a belief that we're able to pay this off, and creditors are many continue to provide that credit in their belief that they're going to be paid, it became very, very easy to continue that expansion. And with the unit of currency that we have and how it exists, that even facilitates it more. 2007, 2008 created the first sign of that lack of confidence, which goes into my second economic law, which is deflation is a lack of confidence.
All right, well, so let me stop you. We'll go to deflation in a second. I want to come back to what you said, because I think you're right, and let me see if I've got it right. The way I would separate this is, are you saying that credit for consumer goods is generally a bad idea, but credit for investments that might generate business money, income to pay off the debt, is generally good?
I would say, again, to use that word generally, because you could borrow money for an investment on something that you feel is productive, but then essentially becomes a malinvestment.
Right.
And again, likewise, from a consumer perspective, I don't want to decry someone who wants to go out and buy something for consumer purposes, because essentially that's one of the measures, if you will, of, you know, productivity, economic growth, well-being, and so forth, is the ability of consumers to do what? To consume. It's just that first paragraph that you read in from page 224, that factor of safety now is gone. And so if my economic factor of safety before was a 2.5 or a 3.0, now it's 1.0 or maybe even less than 1. And that's where I'm getting at. I think we got out of whack in that regard.
So if we're going to make an investment, or going to borrow money to make an investment, be that start a business or buy a piece of real estate, we've got to have ways, sources of repayment, ways to deal with it when everything goes wrong. We've got to have plans for what to do when, say, the piece of property that we bought is vacant or partially vacant or needs a new roof and so forth. So you need emergency plans. But would you agree with me that consumer credit is almost always a bad idea?
It's more perilous. How about that? You know, I mean, I'll be, let me just relate a personal example. When I graduated from college, I wanted a sports car and I wanted it really badly. And I remember my first salary out of college, and I bought this sports car, and my dad made a comment to me, and he said, "Well, Jim, you know, you realize that the price that you're paying for this car is roughly half of what your first year salary is going to be." And it didn't strike me as anything because I knew I could make the payments. But, you know, he was absolutely right. I mean, I tightened my economic factor of safety because I spent more on a car than I needed to. Now, I still needed to apply for credit in order to buy that car. But did I really need to spend half of my, again, my gross income, not even my net income, on that car? And I think probably the answer is no. So again, it's just the question of, you've got these consumer goods, you have a consumer orientation, but let's be careful about, you know, what that factor of safety is going to be with respect to your purchase.
So I could see how someone could make an exception to this rule, but I think a starting place might be, if I were giving it advice to someone starting out in life, the advice I would give is, if you can't afford to pay cash for a car, then you need to get a less expensive car. That if you think you need a car that's more expensive, but it's going to have payments that are going to go on for 3 or 4 or 5 years, that's not the car for you. And I made that suggestion to someone, to a young person who is the son of a client of mine in my real life, where I'm a practicing real estate and business attorney. I made that suggestion to him, and he said, "Well, I deserve a car as much as anyone else." And to me, it struck me as the contamination of the culture of credit, where it was a sense of, I deserve it, and credit is the way I can get it, where the way I look at it is that car is nothing but an albatross and a burden to him, and the enjoyment of purchasing the car, yeah, he may even enjoy it thoroughly, but what he pays in lost opportunities for it will delay his entry into, for example, owning a home or buying an apartment building or buying stocks or something to begin to prepare for a retirement that might still be decades away. So my starting place is, if you can't pay for a consumer item in cash, it's probably in your best interest not to buy it.
Yeah, I don't think I could have said it much better than you did, particularly with the example of a car. I mean, a car is something that we all know that once you leave that lot, it begins to, it's already depreciated. And so this kind of gets back to that issue that I was talking about, is what did you borrow that money for? Now, that car may be essential for you for transportation to and from your employment. But again, I'll just go back. I'll reflect on myself. Did I need to buy that sports car? No, I didn't. I could have gotten away with something far less and had more available funds to, like you said, invest in stocks, a piece of real estate, whatever it is, something that has the potential for some appreciation.
You know, then the car I picked, because it's a large enough item, you know, it doesn't make all that much difference if someone buys a $800 computer on their credit card and takes months to pay it off, because it isn't that life-changing, although those little things add up. But a car is big. The next thing on my list would be a house. And the question would be, how can buying a house be a very good or a very bad idea? And that is what I want to talk about when my conversation continues with Jim Mascara. We're talking about a book that you can buy right now, right here on the Talk Radio 1 website. It's called Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. And this is a book that is very user-friendly. It's something that you can get through and enjoy. It's got a lot of technical information, but it's presented in a way that makes it easy to access, understand, and learn from, together with very specific suggestions as to how people should think when they think about their money. We're coming to you live from Los Angeles. I'm Stephen Spear. This is TalkRadio1.com. Back in less than 60 seconds.
The Stephen Spear Show will return in less than a minute. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.
Here's a fun game to play. What don't they sell at Amazon.com? With deep discounts on the stuff you buy most, delivered free when you spend just $25, and in most states, no tax. Plus, it's easy to help support the fine programming here on Talk Radio 1 without costing you a penny extra. Just use our link before you shop Amazon. We get a small percentage. Your friends and family, if they use our link, we might be able to afford some new windscreens. And then if they told two friends to use our link, we could afford a toll-free number. And then if they told two friends, we could afford a lavish party for listeners. And if those people all told two of their friends, we could buy a Talk Radio 1 corporate jet. And if they told two of their friends, then we could afford our own island in the Caribbean where all the hosts could live and broadcast like one big happy family. And then if they told two friends, world domination. You see, it starts with just your purchases on Amazon.com through our link here on TalkRadio1.com.
We now return to the Stephen Spear Show, celebrating life through personal growth on TalkRadio1.com.
I am Stephen Spear. This is TalkRadio1.com. My guest is Jim Mascaro. We're talking about money. And a house seems to be something that seems to be the American dream, and yet a few years ago we saw it turn into the American nightmare for many. Jim, how has the concept of home ownership evolved over just the most recent decades?
I have a chapter, Stephen, in the book. It's called Investor Psychology. And what I try to do in that is to try to show people how investors think about, you know, different asset classes. And let's pick on real estate for a second. Crowd following is something that, or herding is another term that can be used, that occurs in a variety of investment vehicles. And real estate is certainly one of them. And part of the problem that I saw with real estate is that a public was convinced that the roof over their heads turned into an investment. And that's something that was certainly promulgated by, you know, the real estate industry. I'm certainly government had a hand in it as well. And it was interesting because, I'll relate back to a personal story. When I bought my first house, I remember we were sitting there with the loan officer, and they wanted us to list some of the assets. And after we did that, the loan officer looked at us and said, you know, why aren't you buying a more expensive house? And it kind of goes back to what I was saying about the car earlier. Now, this house purchase occurred many years after the car. But at that point in time, I realized, I could have bought a much more expensive house, but I chose not to because I didn't think about that roof over my head as an investment. And I think the reason people thought it was an investment is because home ownership prices increase substantially. But let me cite you some interesting statistics about home ownership that occurred, let's say, from the late 1940s to the early 1970s, that the home ownership percentage in the United States went from 43% of the population to 63% of the population. So pretty significant increase. But if you look at the outstanding real estate credit during that time, it rose very little. So, and then the next 20-year period from 80 to 2000, real estate debt tripled, more than tripled, but yet home ownership rates were only marginally higher. And then from 2000 to 2008, you know, when right in that time we had the real estate top, home ownership rates again increased just a little bit more, but the real estate debt doubled yet again. And so what that was showing you during that time was that people were spending more on their houses because, again, it was credit chasing an item, real estate, propelling those prices higher. But in the end, if you looked at the net that was owned, if you will, by the homeowner, they really weren't gaining anything. So you had higher price real estate and then less overall ownership of it. But yet in the minds of people, they still thought about it as an investment. Well, here's the other problem with the roof over your head is that it's not like a stock that has this great liquidity that, okay, I'm going to call my stockbroker or do it online and sell it. You know, if you sell that roof over your house, what does that mean? Well, it means you need to find somewhere else to live. So very, very flawed thinking with respect to real estate, particularly as being viewed as an investment as opposed to just really a consumption item.
My mom's older brother, my Uncle Ben, bought his house with his wife, my Aunt Faye, on December 18th, 1949. Now, I remember that because it was my parents' anniversary, December. It's the day they got married, the very same day as the day that Uncle Ben and Aunt Faye moved into their house. And they bought a house in Culver City, which is a suburb of Los Angeles, and they paid $9,000 for it. And by the time that house was sold in about 2005 or 2006, it sold for nearly $1 million. And what happened, I think this is one of the things that happened that caused people to have the illusion that a house, a single family residence in which they live, is an investment, because it went up so dramatically. Now, this hadn't happened before 1970, really. Prices since the Depression of the 1930s had gone up only somewhat, and it was never really an investment. But you bought a house anyway because it was to put a roof over your head. The idea was that it was better than renting because the payment was deductible rather than not deductible, and that you would have control over your property and no one would raise your rent, and over the years it would be better than renting. So it was better than renting, and that was the idea. But in about 1970, we had double-digit inflation through the 70s. And I remember my dad's brother, Uncle Bill, in about 1971 saying, I want to upgrade my house. I want to move out to Northridge in the San Fernando Valley, and I want to buy a nicer house. But I'm going to wait, he said, until prices come back down because they're crazy. Now, he said this in about 1971. Well, about 8 years later, 1978, 79, he finally gave up and thought, well, I guess they're never coming down, and he bought a house. Of course, the recession hit in 1980, and they went down a little bit. They didn't go all the way back down. But the illusion that was created during that time, during the 70s, was that owning a house was an investment. It was an investment because so many people who had just bought a house to put a roof over their head were the first people to tell you how really smart they were to have bought the house, because look at how much money they made. And that created the sense that if you bought a house, no matter what you paid for, it would be worth more later, and therefore it was a good idea and it was an investment. And that, to me, looks like one of the two factors that led us to where we are now. I got a second factor, but I want to get your observations about what I just said, Jim.
Yeah, that's part of that real estate psychology. And one of the things I talk about in the book is I talk about something called credit cones. And so what you were highlighting earlier about the availability of credit, and we were talking more for specific consumer items, but let's throw real estate into that bucket as well. Whenever there's the ease of credit creation, there's the willingness of borrowers to take on credit. Again, back to that whole, the belief system to credit is means to believe. And once that happens, that credit looks for places to go. And one of the places was the real estate market. Another one was the stock market and the bond market. We can talk about those later. But the real estate market was probably front and center for all that. But then you also had that whole concept being fostered by government. Government took an active part in trying to promote home ownership. You know, you had government-sponsored entities like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that also promulgated that. And so you really had the whole edifice of, you know, government, the credit markets, et cetera, that were really facilitating that whole process. And so once that occurred, it allowed people that perhaps weren't as qualified. Again, let's go back to that factor of safety that I mentioned, that you get into a real estate purchase, the lender was probably more than happy to loan you the money, but from an individual perspective, should you have taken on that credit based on your own personal circumstances? And I think that, as we found out later, the answer to that was no.
You know, it's interesting because you have led me to my second point. I agree with you completely, Jim. The second thing I think contributed to the catastrophe of the late 2008-2009 was that sometime in the 1970s and 80s, when prices had gone up, politicians, well-intentioned politicians, these are not bad guys, these are good guys, and these are not just Republicans or Democrats, these are Republicans and Democrats, came out and said, we need to make homes affordable. We need to make them accessible. We need to increase the percentage of people in the United States who actually own their own home, because home ownership is good, because remember, we figured out it's an investment. It's not, but that's what the politicians said. And so they said, we need to make credit more available. And so what they did is they started allowing people to borrow money that they couldn't pay back. And the rationale for the politicians was, yes, this way they can get into the housing market, and someday the house will go up so much in value that they'll be able to refinance and put on better financing. And then someday they'll have a retirement there and they'll be able to provide for themselves. It's kind of a forced savings plan. And so let's get more people into the market that way by making credit more easily available. And so they did. And throughout the late 90s and early 2000s, we had what were commonly in the real estate industry called liar's loans, where the loan broker would ask you, what do you make? And you'd say, well, you know, I make $2,000 a month. They'd say, well, you need to write down that you make $8,000 a month because then you'll get the loan. And the borrower would say, well, but I don't. And our broker would say, well, no, this is just how it works. And they were called stated income loans, again, commonly called liar's loans, but they were called stated income loans. You didn't have to do full documentation, and you could get phenomenal amounts of money. I remember a client telling me that his son, who made $50,000 a year, was buying a $500,000 house with no money down. And I said, well, how's that going to work? And the dad says, I don't know. I don't know how he'll ever pay it back. I just hope we have to hope that the property values keep going up. Well, he said that in early 2008. And, of course, he lost that. The son lost it in foreclosure about 2 years later. So this easy credit drives prices up is my central idea. And I think you agree with that based upon what I read in your book.
100% correct. Yeah. And so part of the problem with the example that you gave also is that, and again, not to harp on the point about the factor of safety, but if you buy a $500,000 house and you don't have any equity in it, think about what a loss of 1 or 2% of that market value already means to you, right?
Yeah.
So that's immediate negative equity. Here's the other thing that I don't think people really understand as well. In the United States right now, you still have X number of millions of homes that are technically underwater, so they have negative equity. But
let's make sure everybody understands what we mean. That means that the homeowner owes more money on the house than the house would sell for.
That's correct. But there's another statistic there that I think people are overlooking. Is let's go back to the example that you gave of the $500,000 house with no equity. Let's say, as an example, that young man, about 6 months in, got another opportunity to go work somewhere else and needed to sell that house. And let's say at that point, they still don't have any equity in it. Well, what happens at that point is that you have what's called effective negative equity, which means that when you sell that house, you're going to have to pay the real estate agent, right? And you're going to have to move and you're going to have to do something in your next house. So you don't even have the funds at that point to make an effective real estate transaction to get out of that house and go to the next house. And so there's actually a decent number of homes in the United States right now that are in that effective negative equity bucket as well. So if you take into account real negative equity and then effective negative equity, you really have a real estate market right now that's kind of locked up because a lot of people.
Oh, it's completely locked up.
Because they can't move.
We have a lower volume, a lower market velocity of sales and purchases of used homes now, and have had that for the last half dozen years than ever this in the past 100 years. And you have a very small number of people who are in a position to sell and then buy because of the problem of getting credit to buy up, or even the problem of getting out of the existing house to buy down, to buy something less expensive. It's a problem.
Yeah, and one of the other thing that needs to be considered in this whole aspect of the credit cones that I mentioned is, in order for these credit cones to continue, what has to happen? More credit needs to be pumped in there. And so there was a recognition, the market had a recognition in 2008, 2009, and that's why you just mentioned that it's more difficult to get credit. Well, in order to continue the propagation of these credit cones, more credit needs to be pumped into those cones. Well, if there's a curtailment of that credit, then those cones aren't expanding like they were before, and market prices will be affected accordingly, and then you have essentially what you have right now in the real estate market, which is what I'll call somewhat of a lockup, where people are kind of forced where they are, and they don't have that flexibility that they once had.
It's going to sound like I'm changing the subject, Jim, but I'm really not. I want to talk about the cost of college, the cost of university, and what our topic of cash and credit has to do with that. And that's what I want to do in my conversation continues with Jim Mosqueira. We are live from Los Angeles. This is TalkRadio1.com. I'm Stephen Spear, back in less than 60 seconds.
Live from Los Angeles, you're with the Stephen Spearer Show. Back in less than 60 seconds. This is TalkRadio1.com.
Listeners to Talk Radio 1 have been asking, besides using the Amazon.com link before you buy, how can we support the fine programming on Talk Radio 1? Well, now you can. You see that link on the right side of the Talk Radio 1 homepage that says Donate to TRO? You can make a one-time donation of any amount, or you can give us a couple bucks every month. No long-term commitment. You can unsubscribe anytime. Our goal is to keep the live shows streaming at no cost, and we can only do that with your help. As broadcast radio becomes more predictable and fewer voices dominate, Talk Radio 1 strives to present more shows with a larger variety of opinion, and that future can only happen with your help. So, if you can, throw a few bucks our way. With 7 billion people on Earth now, just think if one in a million gave us just $10. We'd have like, let's see, 10 bucks times 1,000 divided by 7, carry the... It would be a lot of money.
Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com. Now back to Stephen Spear.
I am Stephen Spear. This is TalkRadio1.com. My guest is Jim Mosqueira. He is the author of Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. You can buy that book here on the TalkRadio1.com website and own it. It's a book that I recommend. You know, there's a lot in the press now about how expensive colleges are, and I visited a college campus recently, and the new facility has granite countertops. This is for the dorms. Has new granite countertops and stainless steel appliances. These kids in college are now going to be living in conditions which they will not be able to afford again on their own for decades, as a consequence of coming out with tens of thousands, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars in college debt for tuition and books and lodging and housing, and the colleges are becoming more expensive by the year. I've got a theory as to how that happened, and I want to see if you do.
Well, I used the term credit cone earlier, and it applies here once again, and there's a reason for that. Number one, how was the credit made available for the students to borrow, right? And these are coming from government programs. And so once that credit exists, it finds its way into something. In this particular case, that something is higher education. And again, promulgating the thesis that in order to be successful in life, you need a college education. And while there's obviously plenty of studies that indicate, yes, if you have a high school education historically throughout the course of your life, you're probably not going to make as much as a college graduate, albeit no question about it. I'll relate some personal facts to you here. In my former life, I had to hire people, and this was in the technology field, and I was surprised that there were a number of people in the technology field that may have had degrees that didn't have technological backgrounds. And there were a fair number of people that were in the industry, probably still are, that didn't have any college degrees at all and were making very, very good salaries. I think we've gotten away also from technical training that, again, is very specialized, probably doesn't need a college degree. But the thought process in most people's minds is, I have to send my kids to college. I can tell you categorically that when I went to college many years ago, there were a lot of people that didn't belong in college, and they ended up essentially wasting their parents' money. But what you have now is, you know, you have student debt that's sitting above, you know, $1.2 trillion. A good percentage of that is delinquent. And it's the colleges themselves are benefiting from this, because if you think about it, they're not owed money from anybody, because once that student gets the loan, then that money gets directed to the college. So that collection process, that debtor creditor relationship, doesn't sit with that college or university. And one of the other thing that's, I think, exacerbating student debt is the fact that, and I cite this statistic in the book, that out of 580 public institutions that were surveyed, only 50, so less than 10%, have a four-year graduation rate at or above 50%. So what that tells you is it's taking people longer to go through that college process. And what does that mean? More costs. And that cost is, the college and university, they already have their money. So the student is going to be responsible for that. Typically, that debt is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. And this is where you are today. And one more final statistic with this. If you look at consumer credit since the 2008-2009 timeframe, mortgage debt has contracted. Revolving credit cards, that's contracted. But the one area of consumer credit that's actually grown has actually been student debt.
You know, it's amazing. First of all, I agree with everything you just said, and I think that's exactly the reason. I think there were two separate instances of government action, again, well-intentioned, which have created a horrible situation for students. The first one was because politicians, Democrats and Republicans, said that a college education leads to a better life and more money, so we've got to give access to people who don't have money so they can get to college. So let's create student loans. The colleges looked at that, and being human beings, they looked at it and said, well, this is great. We can charge more because then we can build better facilities. We can hire better teachers. We can build better buildings. We can build a beautiful gym. We can have granite countertops and stainless steel appliances in our dorms, and we can do all kinds of things that will be wonderful. And then what happened, the second thing that happened, is students came out with huge student debt as a result of those prices going up because they could borrow money easily to do it. And then they would go bankrupt. They'd get out of law school or medical school or dental school or even college, and they would bankrupt out of the debts. So the government said, well, now, wait a minute, that's not fair. We wanted to help you get an education, and now you're bankrupting. So they passed rules that said you cannot bankrupt out of almost any student debt. Well, that only brought the lenders in even more because the lenders said, oh, great. Now we know we're going to get paid back. It might take 20 or 30 years, but they're going to pay us back. So we'll lend them even more money. And the schools responded by saying, well, great. There's even more money available. Now we can build more. We can have larger full-time enrollment. We can set up endowments. We can redo that yard out there. We can build a football stadium. We can do whatever we need to do because there's plenty of money available because it's borrowed money and it's government guaranteed. And so everybody wins? I don't know. I think that what happens is the students, as you said, Jim, college education is wasted on people who don't belong in college, and many people who go to college don't even know why they're in college, except I think I'll make more money. I mean, I've asked many, and that's the answer you get. So they haven't figured out the real reason that they should be in college or why, separate, perhaps in addition to that, but certainly separate from that. And so it results in that. So here's my overall theory. Easily available credit drives prices up, whether it's houses, automobiles, student loans, anything. Easily available credit drives up prices and hurts the middle class and the poor, but especially the middle class.
Yeah, it's back to that cone concept. It's going to funnel somewhere. And in this particular case, it was specifically allocated to be funneled towards student debt. Let me add a couple more things to what you were talking about with respect to college. The other thing that I see, and this is more of a tactical move on the part of students and parents, is let's say that there's the idea that, okay, junior wants to go to college. And now let's think about, okay, where do we want to send our child to go to college? And one of the things I see is that people are overspending for college with respect to the college that they get sent to, and particularly with certain degrees. There's a number of, let me just pick on liberal arts degrees for a second. I could go to school A and my tuition there is $40,000 a year, just tuition. And I could go to school B, that's a state school, and probably get away with $15,000 to $20,000. Now, at the end of my 4 years or however long it takes, I have a degree that says, okay, I have a bachelor's of arts degrees in this liberal arts discipline. But did I really make a good use of my money by going to this other university where it was twice as expensive? And I think that's a problem, you know, that's more of a tactical issue. The other thing I wanted to mention was, I believe, and I don't remember his name. I think his name is Peter Thiel, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, who was the founder of PayPal.
You are, and he was.
Okay. And I thought he had an offer here not that long ago that he gave high school students an opportunity to say, if you come up with a good business plan, I'll fund you. Instead of going to college, you come up with a business plan and I'll fund you the $200,000.
Drop out of college and I'll take you into business instead.
Exactly. And I think that that's something and that needs to be explored as well, that there's plenty of opportunities for, we see this today in technology, that there's plenty of opportunities to exist outside of the collegiate world, go into business, start a business, create value, potentially expand employment. But that doesn't really get, that much attention. And I've had this discussion with kids that are my son's age, teenagers. And I said, if you don't want to go to college, there's some other opportunities. And they looked at me kind of askance, like, what are you talking about? But I just think that kind of needs to get back into the discussion as well, that college isn't necessary for everybody. There's other honorable professions that are out there that may have absolutely nothing to do with college. Still require training, but it's not necessarily that academic setting of a college or university.
Well, you're 100% right about that. I will tell you that this brings us back to the discussion of what do you go to college for. And certainly one of the reasons would be to get a better job and make more money. But really the main reason to go to college, and it's a perfect thing to do from the age of 18 to 22, is to finish growing up. You're finally leaving childhood and attempting to enter adulthood. And the purpose of going to college, I think, should be to build a better you. So if you're there and you're in college, it would be to learn how you deal with and respond to problems. Are you able to sit in a chair and study? Are you good at that? How do you do in social interactions? How do you do in dealing with your own emotions? So social, emotional, mental, physical, sexual, and by the way, chemical, what is your relationship to drugs or to alcohol? That becomes something which is a major issue on college campuses today, making people into, at least temporarily, into alcohol abusers or drug abusers, rather than figuring out that there's really a challenge there. So if someone goes to college with the idea that they're there to finish growing up and they're there to prepare themselves for an adult life, and therefore they need to learn, what am I good at? What am I not good at? Because we're all good at some things and not good at others. And if someone figures out through the process what they are good at so they can spend their lifetime staying in areas where they're good and figure out what they really ought to avoid so they can avoid those things so they don't have a lot of failure in their life, then it becomes a good idea. But the problem is that so many students go to college and university now with the idea that I'm just here, I'll drink a bunch of beer, and when I graduate, that'll mean I'll get a better job. And that is something that just seems to escape notice when people decide to go to what they will call the best school they can get into, meaning that they academically qualified for it, and so that must make it the best school because it's harder to get into.
I am so glad that you brought this up, because this is a conversation I've had with my teenage son, and I tell him that when I went to engineering school, one of the things that I think was one of the best things about engineering school is they teach you how to learn. And
yes,
a point that resonates with me, and I try to echo this to my son as well, is that when you go to university, you're kind of learning how to learn, because when you go to that first job, it's very likely, and it was 100% likely in my case, that what you learn in college has no direct application to what that first job's going to be. And so when you get to that first job, you're going to have to learn. I mean, it's going to be something new. But because you went to college, and as you mentioned, some of the social development aspects that are native to going away to college and experiencing becoming an adult, now you know how to apply that once you get on that very first job. And I'm going to make one other point about jobs and universities, is that university that you went to is probably very applicable to that very first job that you had. But when I've hired people in my former life, I mean, I saw that they went to a particular university. But what was most important for me as an employer was, where did they work last, or the iteration before that? So in other words, the college degree was important, but the fact that they went to University A versus University B was less important than the job experience that they had after college. So and that gets back to that tactical point that I mentioned earlier about, you got to really, really be careful. Yeah, just because you have the opportunity to go to a $40,000 a year college, should you? Because tactically, that may not be, and economically, that might not be the best thing for you.
You know, a college degree, or actually more of a graduate degree, can help you get your first job. And that really is all it helps you do, because what you said is right, Jim. When an employer is hiring someone after that first job, they're not looking for what school did you go to. They might ask, they might notice, but what they really want to know is, can you get the job done that they need done? They're hiring you to do a job, to perform something. And so you might get that first job, but if you did not learn in college who you are, what your strengths and weaknesses are, you might not keep it. My conversation with Jim Mascaro will continue in a moment. I'm Stephen Spear. We're live from Los Angeles. This is TalkRadio1.com. Back in less than 60 seconds.
Truly fascinating stuff. More coming up in less than a minute on The Stephen Spear Show, right here on TalkRadio1.com.
Sure, you love the fine programming on TalkRadio1.com, and you want to help make sure we stay here. Now you have another avenue of support by doing what you're already doing, buying stuff on eBay. Just like our relationship with Amazon.com, when you click our link on the TalkRadio1.com homepage before you buy, every purchase gives back a little bit to us, and it doesn't cost you anything. Our costs have recently undergone a significant increase, and your support is more important than ever, which is why we're exploring new ways that you can help us when you do what you're already doing. Shopping on eBay has never been easier or more secure with their Get the Item You Ordered or Get Your Money Back with the eBay Money Back Guarantee. So before you buy stuff at the world's largest ongoing auction, eBay.com, use the eBay link on the homepage of TalkRadio1.com.
Welcome back to The Stephen Spear Show, live from Los Angeles on TalkRadio1.com.
I am Stephen Spear. This is TalkRadio1.com, and reading from page 341 of a book called Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis by my guest, Jim Mascaro. He says, don't let your educational process end with this book. Make it the beginning. Ask questions. Get involved. Hold elected leaders accountable. Participate in town hall meetings or other forums. Write letters to the editor. Get involved in civic affairs. Don't be a bystander. Jim, have you considered running for office?
You know, that was said to me a few years ago that I should certainly entertain that. But as you know, running for office nowadays can be very perilous to your health.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. The problem is that with elected officials right now, it doesn't seem that they are in a position as a group. I think as individuals, many of them are well-intentioned, but as a group, they don't seem able to do anything. They seem really, truly paralyzed. What is the problem? What has our government been doing, and what are the things that it needs to do now?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. This is a chapter that I had Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis that I didn't have in the first one. And I intentionally did not want to talk about government in the first book because I really didn't want to have people think this be a political attack on whoever was in office at the time. And I'm glad that you've balanced this discussion that we've had today by saying that this applies to whether you're a Republican or Democrat, Republican Congress, Democrat Congress, presidential office, etc. And that's why I kind of felt compelled to write chapter 18, and the title of that chapter is What Should Government Be? And at the beginning of and end of every chapter, I have like a little quotation that comes from somebody in the beginning of chapter 18. It says, the hardest thing to understand in the world is the income tax. And that was a quote by Albert Einstein. And I put in the introduction to the chapter, I said, this chapter's title is not a rhetorical question. And you might find it strange to have this chapter in a book that's talking about, you know, money, the stock market and the financial markets and so forth. But I personally think that we have just had government really expand its boundaries beyond certainly beyond what the founding fathers, the original conception was of what government needed to be. But we've allowed it to happen. So we can't just blame the politicians and people in office. We've asked for more. And as you aptly noted earlier, well-intentioned politicians, well, they must want this. We should give it to them. And so we've asked. The government has given. But now we've strained government to the point, both at the federal, state, and local level, where, you know, they have these covenants that exist with the population. But financially, we are currently unable in many respects to fulfill those covenants, and certainly on a future basis, we can't fulfill them anyway. So this is why I put this chapter in here, to have people understand why government expanded even beyond the point that they did. In the United States case, we're in a very, very unique position because, you know, we are the reserve currency of the world. And that was something that came about in 1945 with something called the Bretton Woods Agreement, which basically pegged all of the currencies to the U.S. dollar, which, again, not coincidentally, was pegged to something called gold, which we've kind of forgotten about a little bit. So because of that unique position that the United States has, it's really driven our foreign policy. It's driven our domestic policy. Some of that has eroded over time, and it's going to come under greater and greater attack. And that's why I spent some time talking about government. I talked about some of the cycles, some of the thinking that's going to change in the United States with respect to how we view foreign involvement. You're going to see a greater amount of, when I talked about not being a bystander, you're going to see a greater amount of political activism in the years ahead. You've already seen some of that with, you know, the Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street. Now you're seeing a different degree of political activism with respect to law enforcement and how it treats suspects, et cetera. So expect more and more of that to happen. At the end of the day, Stephen, we just need to get back and think about what do we want government to be? What should it be? And when you start out with a clean slate and you make that determination, then say, okay, if we want government to do this, are we willing to pay for it? And that's not just one segment of the population paying for it. That's everybody having a collective responsibility.
You make the point in the book that the government does not create jobs. Every government spending, anything the government spends, is a tax. There's a tax that pays for it. It's the only source of income the government has. And so government really doesn't create jobs. You said in your book that anytime you hear a politician talking about the government creating jobs, or we've got to, as leaders, we've got to create jobs, that people should just roll their eyes. As we enter this season of the presidential campaign leading to the 2016 presidential election, what should we be listening for from any candidate besides that?
I don't know that you're gonna. That's the sad part, is I don't know that you're gonna hear anything but that. And I know that I think President Obama was the one that made a comment in a discussion somewhere about, well, you know, you didn't create this business, you know, government. And it is. I mean, government does have a role in providing that infrastructure for making some of those things happen. But I think that this is where the fallacy is. I think people believe, and this is why I created this whole wizard construct around the books, that government is this magical being, the central banks, the Federal Reserve, are these magical beings that can sprinkle fairy dust over the United States and make things happen. And that's just not true. And so I personally think there needs to be kind of a broader discussion again about, you know, what government's role needs to be, and are we willing to pay for it? There's just some really, really, really tough questions that need to be addressed. Do I see that happening in 2016 with the candidates that are out there? No. And that's why I believe that over the course of time that you'll probably see maybe a third party candidate evolve that will address some of these issues, because if it's just the current players now, I don't see that happening. And then what you're going to end up with is some sort of a cataclysm that then will create that awakening to then take some greater action.
Your book is predicated upon an analogy to the Wizard of Oz, as you just said. And in chapter 19, you quote the Wizard of Oz as saying, "You, my friend, are a victim of disorganized thinking. You are under the unfortunate impression that just because you run away, you have no courage. You're confusing courage with wisdom." And of course, the wizard is talking to the cowardly lion in that scene. And we can all remember that from childhood. Chapter 19 of your book, that starts on page 323 of Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis, sets forth 19 different things, 19 different items for planning for the future. And I've picked a half dozen of them, Jim, and I want you to comment kind of in a lightning round, take a minute or so with each one, and just tell me, in terms of planning for the future, talk about conservation.
Well, you know, consumption, we all want to consume things, and we were talking about earlier in the show about the use of credit, but when we save, so that's the whole concept of conservation, it's deferred consumption. So if you want something now, there's a cost to that. We've made that cost very, very light, but without consequences down the line. With easy credit, it needs to be paid off. So I would say that let's think in terms of capital formation, that we need to build a foundation for the next stage of growth, because we don't really have that now. And really the whole edifice of how government thinks and how central banks think about this is actually opposite of, I think, the way it needs to be.
Less reliance on government promises.
Wow, that's one that I tell some friends of mine. I have some good friends that live in the state of Illinois, and one of them in particular is a state employee. And I mentioned to her that, and I said this to her a few years ago, I said, you know, whatever you think that you might get from a pension from the state of Illinois being an employee, I think you need to adjust that amount. Do your financial planning with that adjusted amount and see how that works for you. Because, I'm picking on the state of Illinois. Obviously, your state has some similar issues.
Sure.
You have seen the courts even getting more involved in this right now with respect to what these obligations represent, and you're a lawyer. I mean, I've heard them described as legal contracts that you can't get out of.
Community support.
In St. Louis, which is where I live, I have seen, and in St. Louis, let me just to kind of a real quick highlight, we weren't as affected by the housing bubble on the plus side or the minus side, because it just, you know, it was a little more level here in St. Louis. But in this city, I have seen the growth of food pantries, you know, food kitchens, et cetera.
Yeah.
I know that in the United States that we have like 13 million more food stamp participants than we did since the official end of the recession in 2009.
Right.
It's going to be a lot more effective to help people, not when it's coming from Washington, D.C. or even your state capital. It needs to be focused more on a community level, because that's where it's really going to have the most impact.
So more help from, if we're going to get help from a government, more help at the local level, the city, county level, maybe the state level, but not from the federal government.
Because that's where there's going to be more knowledge about local problems than there are going to be from somebody that's, you know, a bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. that just doesn't have that, you know, local knowledge.
Political responsibility.
Wow, and when we talked about that, when you read kind of the end of the book, which is to get more politically involved and, you know, become active, because we've been very passive from a political perspective, and, you know, we've had politicians, again, well-intentioned, trying to do things, but there's definitely been a little bit more of an awakening here in the last few years about that, and I really think that we need to question our political leaders a lot more than we have been.
Two more. Creativity.
Creativity. You know, in the business that I'm in right now, which is helping small to mid-sized businesses, acquire capital, maybe being involved with debt restructuring. If you believe that small to mid-sized business is the engine of growth in this country, and I recently wrote an article about that, there's probably like, I think it's like 8 million or so firms that are between 1 and 5 employees. But one of the things that's happened over the course of the last year or so is we have more business deaths in this country than births. And that's a very, very disturbing, alarming trend. And so we need to be able to have these ideas. And we talked earlier about Peter Thiel funding, you know, high school students with money that, you know, maybe they can create some value or create some employment opportunities and so forth. So that small entrepreneur, again, is the engine of growth in the economy, and there's a lot of creativity that comes with that, but we need to be able to foster that.
Last one, debt restructure.
Very intimately involved with that. There's so much civil litigation that goes on, at least in this metropolitan area, with small to mid-sized businesses that are on the other side of civil litigation as a result of debt. I'm not talking about, you know, other types of, you know, personal injury or anything like that, but just purely debt cases that, as you know, really don't resolve themselves in court. And there's a lot of businesses that I can tell you in St. Louis that are basically kind of zombies because they're sitting out there with judgments against them, but no action's been taken because the creditor, you know, hasn't had the means to collect yet, even though that judgment sits out there for 10 years or longer. So there needs to be a very, very painful but frank discussion that all of this debt that exists in the United States today, whether it's at the small to mid-sized business level, even at a federal level, There's not enough value creation in place. There's not going to be enough taxing power in place to potentially even address this debt problem. And that's not just, I'm not just talking about the funded debt of the United States, which is some $18 trillion. There's unfunded liabilities, which are multiples of that number. So that's not going to resolve itself through any sort of organic growth or tax policy. And that's a very, very painful discussion that will have to happen at some point.
This is the third time, Jim, that you've been on our show here on TalkRadio1.com, and it's occurred to me, but I've never asked you, you sound, when you speak, as a person deeply immersed in economics and political science and philosophy and in terms of money management and high finance, but your training is as an engineer. How did you make that transition?
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier that one of the things that I think that engineering is really, really good for, it teaches you how to think and it teaches you how to learn. And I always had this latent interest in money. I mean, that was probably my favorite course in college that was not related to engineering, was money and banking. And I always stayed with that. And then I started to trade commodities. I was, you know, very active in the futures markets, you know, writing software for that, trading on my own account. And so I've always had, you know, kind of this love of things related to money. So and it allowed me, because of my engineering training, to then make that transition on my own.
Jim Mascara, thank you so much for being with me today here on TalkRadio1.com. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Stephen.
My thanks to Jim Mascara, author of Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. You can buy that book right here, right now, on the TalkRadio1.com website. I really recommend this book. This is a book that really will help if you are having trouble figuring out why you're frustrated with money in your life, why it looks like you are working so hard, making a good living, and yet you find yourself unable to make ends meet, unable to really quite put it together. This is a great book to help you think in a whole different way. Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis by Jim Mascara. My next show will be a week from today. My guest is going to be Dr. Marilyn Wedge, and she's written a book called A Disease Called Childhood. I'm looking forward to this because, as you know, this is parenting is one of the things I think is most important in our lives. That's next Saturday, 1 week from today, Saturday, May 16, 2015, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today. I am Stephen Spear. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.